One, I'd like to open up a hearing and meeting for the September 2019 economic forecast. The Senate Revenue Committee will need to adopt rules since this will be the first interim committee of the interim, and we'll then pause and allow the House to do that. We are joined today by Representative Nose. Thanks for sitting up here with us.
Thanks for having me.
I think we're going to have three members, and I'd like to officially welcome Senator Knope to the revenue world as one of our interim appointees. So we have some people on the phone. Senator Bentz, are you there?
No.
We have any hookup? We have a dial tone? It should be working. Those were the famous last words of my Channel 2 news days. It should be working.
It should be. Oh, right. Yeah.
Is anybody on the line?
We should be able to hear them through the microphone.
So, Mr. Chair, is working.
I'm on the phone and I'm fine.
Oh, that sounds like Rep. Nathanson. How are you?
I'm great. How are you? Thank you for being there.
You bet. Senator Bentz?
Yes, Senator, Mr. Chair, I am here.
Senator Bentz, thanks for joining us by phone. And we were just explaining that the Senate Interim Committee needs to quickly adopt committee rules and vote for those. And so we have Senator Knope and you and I as the three senators. And if we all vote yes, then we'll be able to adopt committee rules. And during the interim, you can vote over the phone. So, Senator Knope, you ready? I will open up a work session for purposes of adopting committee rules.
Chair Hess, I move to adopt the Senate committee rules.
Senator Knope moves to adopt the committee rules. Any discussion? Are there any objections? Senator Bentz, how do you vote? Senator Bentz?
He's giving you the...
No objection. I vote yes.
Okay. Senator Bentz votes yes. Knope?
Aye.
And aye. So the committee rules are adopted, and we will move forward and... stand in recess for the House to go through this.
Thank you. Thank you. So the House also needs to adopt interim rules. We do have a four full quorum body here, which is a good thing because we don't allow voting by telephone, just one of the many ways we live in a different environment than mm-hmm. the Senate, although we welcome you, Rep. Nathanson, on the telephone. And so we will entertain a motion for those interim rules. Rep. Finley?
I so move.
Okay. All in favor for those in the room?
Aye.
Aye. And Rep. Nathanson, thank you for being there. We won't let you vote, but you're definitely with us in spirit.
Thank you. And at an appropriate time, I have a short little announcement I'd like to make for House Revenue.
I forgot to pick another session. Do I need to do that? So I'm I was remiss in not calling a work session, so I'll do it now. And we have approved the interim rules. Thank you.
Okay. So the House and Senate Interim Revenue Committees are in session. And with that, we will call up Josh and Mark for this economic forecast. Gentlemen, thanks for being here.
I think she was trying to.
Senator Hass.
Rep. Nathanson.
As they're approaching the table... I make a short statement
for
House Revenue.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Following the work done during the 2019 session regarding the property tax exemption for farm machinery and equipment, you may recall that as House Bill 2264. I have asked 2264.
Go ahead.
Representative Marsh to lead a work group of stakeholders with the following two objectives. one. Your clarity, fairness, and equal application of existing exemptions across the state. I want to be clear, though, that the goal is this clarification, fairness, and equality, and it's not to propose an expansion of existing law. And the second objective is to explore data needs to ensure an equitable implementation of legislative policy with respect to the taxation and exemption of farm property. LRO is staff the work group, and Representative Marsh will be reaching out to stakeholders to schedule an initial meeting during the September legislative days. The work group will provide the full committee with options for potential law changes if they are thought to be necessary. So thank you. Stay tuned. And thank you, Representative Marsh, for doing this.
Mark McMullen and Josh Lennon.
Thanks, Chair Haas, Vice Chair Marsh, members of the committees. For the record, my name is Mark McMullen, Oregon State Economist, joined as always by my colleague, Josh Lehner. And thank you all for being here. I appreciate it. I understand you all have a long way to come, a lot of you, for an end of August informational meeting, and a dry one at that. So in the future, we're going to certainly try to work harder to align these with the legislative days so that you don't have to make a special trip out for our sakes. So this particular forecast, September of an odd year, odd numbered year, is largely a housekeeping forecast where we take stock of what happened in 2017, 2018, try to, you know, get all the end of the biennium accounting records in order, and also try to incorporate any legislative changes that happened during the session. And this session was a very busy one, and so we had quite a bit of work with that to do. So the revenue forecast is going to be a lot of that, taking stock of where we are and housekeeping the outlook and what we have in terms of available balances. But on the econ side, we're going to really talk a lot about the macro economy this time instead of the local regional Oregon economy, because everywhere we go to deliver talks lately, all anyone wants to hear about is recession, recession, recession. What's the recession risk? What's coming forward? Is this long expansion finally coming to the end? And it is certainly true that the U.S. expansion is starting to show some cracks. As a whole, the data flow still remains pretty good, but there are some warning signals that are starting to emerge and that are concerning economists. And what worries us, too, is that, you know, recessions are very much a psychological phenomenon, and I know we've talked about that here. Real coordinated pessimism where everybody pulls back at once. Well, where we are today, where you have every major newspaper on the front page talking about recession risk, recession risk, recession risk over the next year, it wouldn't take much of a shock or a coordinating event to really cause all this, you know, pessimism to create this self-fulfilling prophecy where everyone starts to run and fly away and start. And as soon as, you know, you pull back on your spending as households and firms are doing the same thing, you get into this downward perpetuating cycle. So in terms of forecasters, most are still fairly sanguine about the near term, but the recession risk is rising. The first chart that we prepared here is the risk of recession put together by the Wall Street Journal's survey of professional forecasters. There are similar ones that come out of the Philadelphia Fed and the like, and they're all telling the same story that we've really seen in the past few months. The percent probability of going into a recession within the next year has elevated. Here we're looking at about a 1 in 3 chance on average here across the survey that will go into recession. And if we look at more data-driven probabilities of recession or models as well, they're usually based on financial indicators. Those are telling about the same story, somewhere between a third and a 50% risk of recession in the near term. So these have increased, but, you know, right now, while one third of economists would say, you know, there is we're likely to go into recession over the past year, that's still a majority, two thirds of economists would say no, which would be more comforting to us if we weren't so crappy at predicting recessions. which we have a very poor track record of doing in the past. And so, well, in terms of a third probability of recession, this is about as bad as it gets. You see over our history here, this 10-year sample, we got pretty close to this in late 2011 when there were Eurozone debt issues and we were still growing very slowly then. And there was a narrative about the economy and stall speed, that if you fly close to the ground, you're more likely to crash. I'm not so sure how much I bought into that, but that turned out to be a short-term, concern for most forecasters, whereas this one might extend a little bit better. But again, most indicators are still positive, in particular the big ones. The biggest ones out there would be consumer spending. It's two-thirds of the economy, and the consumers here, at least in the U.S., are still spending their money, and they're likely to continue to do so as long as they have jobs, and the prospect of those jobs going forward remains healthy. And so that's the positive. Well, what's the negative? Well, there are a couple of things that folks are really focusing on right now. One is in the bond market. We're getting some traditionally bad signals, and we'll talk a little bit about that. And then secondly, a combination of seeing a manufacturing contraction start and a lot of uncertainty with regards to trade policy that people are worried about as well. So we'll kind of flesh out those two things, and those things are really, I think, the largest drivers behind looking at these concerns rise, both in terms of these qualitative surveys like the data here in front of you, as well as the quantitative models that economists use. So the first one that we hear a lot about is the Treasury yield curve. And the yield curve it talks about the differences in rates between short-term bonds and with short-term maturities and long-term bonds. And the concern is when these things become flipped, when borrowing money for the short term costs more than borrowing money for the long term, that can be problematic, or has proven to be, for future growth. Over the past few years, the rates have been pretty well behaved. Here you see the movements in interest rates between December 2015 and December 2018, which is when the Federal Reserve started raising rates, their tightening cycle, in December of 2015, and stopped with that last rate increase in December of 2018. And here things have been pretty well behaved. As they increased these federal funds rate, and the short-term rates rose right up with them. But that whole time, we saw these long-term rates, the 30-year was just anchored at 3%, wasn't going anywhere. And that has a lot to do with inflationary expectations, what the market out there really thinks is going to happen with prices, and no matter really, and long-term growth. And no matter what the Fed was doing in the short term, that didn't really impact inflationary expectations, which were really held in check. But now, more recently, we've seen a different kind of picture in terms of the yield curve, where we do have a small inversion, meaning some of our short-term rates now are higher than other long-term rates, and that's really been driven by this big drop in this long-term inflationary expectation, or this 30-year rate, which we're now down to 2%, which can be scary in terms of our outlook over the long haul. We have experience now in the global economy of seeing what's happened with Japan, who for 30 or 40 years has been struggling to get up to 2% inflation rate. And, given our demographics, which aren't as extreme as theirs, but are a little bit lagged behind what they've seen, there is a concern that the same sort of stuff could happen here. But while we get these inverted yield curves, and economists argue strongly that there isn't a real strong causality here, that this does not mean we're going to go into a recession. It just so happens that 6 months or 18 months later, almost every time, we do seem to end up in a contraction. But, case by case, economists can make some pretty compelling arguments for why this isn't a problem this time. And they tend to almost every single time this happens, and then we start having problems. But there is some loose causality that you can apply in both directions. One, well, why does the yield curve get inverted in terms of the prices of funds? Well, one real simplistic way of looking at it is say, okay, if I've got a wad of money, I can do a couple things with it. One option I have is to just stuff it in the mattress and sit on it. And if I do that, my cost is really this inflation, this long-term inflation. My other option is to make use of it, put it in some kind of investment in the economy, you know, make the put the money to work. But my concern there is, what about the risk of short term? What about this recession that might come? What's going to happen to my sales next year? And so what happens when people are more concerned about the risk than they are about losing money to this inflation? Well, then it's more, you get this incentive to stuff stuff in the mattress rather than let your money work, and that's bad for economic activity. And the causality works the other way as well. Once you do get this inverted yield curve, it means, well, the price of money tomorrow is less than the price of money today. And whenever you have deflation or lowering prices, that's not good for the economy. If it's a car, for example, if I expect the price of the car I want to be lower 2 years from now than it is today, then I have an incentive to wait to purchase that. And so this is a cycle that people are worried about. So far, it's just barely inverted, if not at all, in terms of some of the yield differences people look at, the most common one being the 10-year to 2-year. But nevertheless, this is one of the things that has certainly triggered a lot of economists' concerns, and more so has really affected some of these quantitative models that try to predict economy. So moving on, I'm going to pass along to Josh. We'll talk a little bit about some of these cracks in the manufacturing and trade sectors.
Chair Haas, Vice Chair Marsh, for the record, Josh Lehner with the Office of Economic Analysis. I think it's important to remember or to think about some of that inversion in the yield curve with that falling interest rate in really over this past year in those medium and long-term scenarios is also about market expectations that we're having a slower economy and the Federal Reserve is expected to cut interest rates. And the Federal Reserve has already started to cut interest rates and they've signaled they're going to cut them further. So therefore, the rates are a little bit lower from a policy perspective as well. And so I think what's going on there, right? I think two big things. One is we've had some really significant data revisions to the U.S. economy when it comes to GDP. GDP was revised down to show that growth is slower than expected, or growth was slower than initially believed along the preliminary estimates, and that growth peaked at the start of 2018 and has really tapered over the course of the last year. And right now, we're no longer growing above trend or above potential. The U.S. is somewhere around potential, which isn't a bad place to be, right? Particularly in the 11th year of an expansion, growing at your potential is still solid, but it's expected to slow further, and sort of that fiscal boost due to the tax cuts and spending package at the federal level maybe had less of an impact on the economy than initially believed. So the economy was smaller and slower growing than we thought. And then employment revisions that are forthcoming from the Bureau of Labor Statistics show that the job growth acceleration at the national level last year are going to be almost entirely revised away, right? There was no pickup in U.S. job growth in 2018, whereas previous data showed that we had it, right? So we have a slower growing and weaker economy than we thought just a couple months ago. And so that's weighing on investor expectations and in the overall outlook. But then we also have on top of that the escalation of the trade war. And here, a lot of the top line indicators, if you look at the top two charts here, total manufacturing output in Oregon or the U.S. Or manufacturing employment in Oregon in particular, and less so at the U.S., are still looking good, right? They're still showing growth. They have an expectation that this isn't going to be revised away either. This is real growth. But we're starting to see some cracks form below the surface, and that's kind of the bottom two charts. Exports are in U.S. are down. Exports in Oregon for most products are down significantly over the last year and a half, except we have a couple of idiosyncratic things going on, particularly exports to China for our high-tech products and chemicals. And by chemicals, generally the research has shown, I don't have the exact data for recent periods, but historically the growth in chemical exports from Oregon tends to be potash coming from Canada that's barged down, or not barged, but is railed down here and then exported across the ocean. So it's coded as an Oregon export, but it's not really an Oregon product. And there's some jobs associated with it from the longshoremen and the logistics and what have you, but it's not really an Oregon economic thing. These have surged in the last 6 months to China specifically, right? So Oregon exports overall look pretty good and a lot better than the U.S., but for these very specific reasons. On the high-tech side, the question we had is Does this represent new growth opportunities and sales increases abroad for Oregon manufacturers and the high-tech industry? The answer is it could be yes. The other question, though, is does this represent firms trying to get ahead of potential escalation in the trade war? To date, semiconductors and most of our tech products have been exempted from tariffs, right? But that may not be the case moving forward. They could be brought into the fray moving forward. So maybe our firms want to make sure we have some of our supplies in advance of any potential escalation. I think that's where a lot of our advisors landed. That seems to be a likely scenario. But if we get away from the high tech and the chemicals, Oregon exports from agricultural products, timber products, and machinery and equipment and things like that are down pretty substantially over the last couple of years. So that means if sales are down and exports are down, that probably means industry output will be slower moving forward as one of those legs of growth and one of those opportunities is being removed due to the trade war. We're also seeing that in the hours worked on the bottom right-hand chart, right? Our manufacturing workers here in Oregon and across the country are working fewer hours today than they were 6 months ago. This is another indication that industry output is weakening or at least slowing, even though it hasn't shown up in those top-line data yet. And so our outlook for manufacturing in Oregon remains a little bit of growth, relatively stable. We're not seeing a lot of job losses or predicting a lot of job losses as of today. But to the extent that these conditions deteriorate further, I think we'd start to put some more of those declines in the outlook. But again, for now, stability is better than the alternative. It's also important to keep in mind is that manufacturing today, while larger in Oregon than in the typical state, makes up a smaller share of our economy than it has, really since our agricultural days, 100, 150 years ago. One out of 10 jobs, roughly speaking, are manufacturing, whereas, you know, post-World War II is one out of three jobs are manufacturing. So we can have sector-specific shocks, sector-specific recessions and declines in manufacturing that don't necessarily spell doom for the entire economy and drag the entire U.S. down with it, which we saw in 2005 or 2015, 2016 with the oil shock and manufacturing recession associated with the drop in oil prices. That did not bring the U.S. down with it. And so the expectations or thinking could be we could see that sort of thing moving in the future because manufacturing is a smaller share of the economy. Doesn't mean there's not an impact. It just means it will not drive the entire business cycle. That is yet to be determined. And that's also important to point out that the escalation in the trade war, the most recent rounds of it, have all been in the last couple of weeks. It's not in the data yet. We don't know exactly how this will fall out in terms of exports and hours worked and industrial production and what have you. With that said, you know, that's probably the most worrisome sign we're seeing out there today is the manufacturing and trade-related activity. But as Mark said, you know, consumer spending is holding up well. And consumers will continue to spend and continue to do well until given a reason to be scared. And the reason they typically get scared and pull back on their spending is job prospects. And here we're looking at the share of the prime working age population in Oregon and the U.S. that actually has a job. And we're at a cycle high, right? We're now at a cycle high and above actually where we were during the peak of the housing boom 10, 15 years ago. We're a little lower than we were at the peak of the 80s boom here in Oregon, and a little lower than we were at the peak of the tech boom here in the late 1990s. So there's a little bit more room to grow. We have some Oregonians on the sidelines that are still slowly coming back into the economy today. Now the jobs are more plentiful, and firms are more willing to hire people with gaps on their resume or incomplete skill sets and the like. But again, job prospects remain bright. Consumer spending continues to hold up until then. And the best leading indicator for the labor market is initial claims for unemployment insurance. We have not really seen those tick up at all, right? We're at or near historic lows for initial claims for unemployment insurance, both in Oregon and at the U.S. So job prospects remain bright, and so consumers will continue to spend. More importantly, locally, this is translating into better income growth, and in particular, our wages. Here, we're doing a measure of Oregon's average wage relative to the U.S. average wage. And again, Oregon has lower wages than the U.S. We've always had lower wages than the U.S. However, our relative vantage point today is the highest it's been since the heyday of the timber industry in the 1970s, right? We've seen tremendous growth in our wages in Oregon vis-a-vis the U.S. While the U.S. average wage growth has now just kind of picked up to around 3.1% on a year-over-year basis for the typical worker at the U.S. level, well, Oregon's been in the 3-4% average wage growth for really 4+ years now. And our forecast expects that we'll continue to see 4% average wage growth for Oregon workers over the forecast horizon, really up until the next recession, right? These dynamics of where Oregon kind of hits the sweet spot is expected to continue. Our job growth is enough to keep up with population gains. We're bringing some more workers off the sidelines, and that's translating into better income growth than we have seen in the recent past, and better than our U.S. counterparts. And this is really, really the good news when it comes to the tighter labor market. It's harder for employers to find workers because there's not unemployed Oregonians just sitting around waiting for a job, but it's translating into more money in the pockets of our households. We put it all together. We've used this chart quite a bit with you over the last year. The expansion is continuing, right? Our baseline expectation is the expansion continues and continues to improve. The economy has never been bigger and will continue to get bigger each year moving forward. But that pace of growth is starting to slow down for a variety of reasons. We feel really strongly about our medium and long-term outlook, where the demographics will weigh on these net growth rates considerably. We're starting to enter into the peak retirement years for the baby boomers, where they start to enter into their late 60s and into their 70s, where more and more individuals are retired. Whether they have the financial resources to retire comfortably or not, by the time you're in your mid-70s, very, very few Oregonians are actively engaged in the labor force. And so this retirement flows weigh on the net growth rates. And even though there will be plenty of millennials and Gen Zs and alpha gens behind them to replace them in the workforce, the net gains are relatively slow compared to our history. So that's what's dragging down the growth rates over the medium and long run, which is a very powerful force. In the near term, we're a little unsure of exactly how we'll match this transition from today's growth rates to those lower sustainable population-driven growth rates in 5 to 10 years. We have a lot of different things slowing us down, but the year-to-year certainty or uncertainty regarding that transition has us a little bit on edge. But we know that the interest rates, past interest rates have slowed economic growth. The trade war is weighing on the uncertainty in business investments, and the fiscal boost from the federal tax cuts is behind us. We're not cutting taxes again, or at least not today, and so there will be less fiscal boost from policy moving forward, and all of that will weigh on the growth rates in the next year to two.
So in the baseline outlook, we're not looking at a recession, but rather a continued transition down to these sustainable rates that Josh described. And here over the last 2 or 3 years, that's already been occurring, as you see here, with Oregon decelerating now into the range of the average state in terms of job growth. And that has been pretty much in line with what our forecast has been and the outlook that we put in front of you all in terms of the employment and the economic outlook. The problem has been in translating that into revenues. And in recent months, we're still in the position where revenue growth is far stronger than the underlying economy would suggest it should be, or what the underlying economy can support. And we saw that throughout the peak of the collections season and the tax season here in the first half of the year. So the first order of business, again, is to do some of this housekeeping and go ahead and close the books on 2017-2019 biennium. And here is how the personal income came in since the last forecast we provided to you. And as you see here, still continuing to be extremely strong in terms of, final payments up 60% year over year, 58%, and the refunds out the door down 27%. So on a whole, we saw, personal income tax during the peak processing season up 32% relative to last year. Our forecast only had 22%. Very strong growth we're expecting, but it continued to really outstrip our expectations. And not just in terms of the – oh, yes. Sorry, Senator Ass.
Rep. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. After 20 years, I've realized sometimes it's good to slow up so we all understand what we're looking at. When we look at these dollars, let's just take actual revenue of $1,999. Can you tell me is that $1,999,000,000? Yes.
I'm sorry, Representative Smith, Chair Haas. Yeah, to slow down, these are in millions of dollars. So that's and that top part is the withholding you're looking at. So roughly $2 billion in withholdings out of paychecks and retirement checks and the stuff that's pulled out automatically. Most of it's out of labor income.
So let me follow up. I've been doing Ways and Means for 20 years. I know our general fund is approximately $24 billion. Is that $1,999 a difference between the last biennium? Help me understand what that number really is, knowing that our general fund brings in a certain amount. I really want to understand this. Yeah, after 20 years, I want to know this.
Sorry, Representative Smith, I'll slow down. It is a lot of numbers on the chart here. So what this is it's a look at just those last 3 months of the biennium. So this is a snapshot and just the personal income tax component, which is the biggest part of the general fund and the hardest one to predict. And so these are just the sums of what we've seen over the last 3 months. So that first column is the actual what came in the door. The next one is what we expected 3 months ago. And then for reference, how size was the year before.
Mr. Chair, I didn't mean to slow us up, but I really wanted to make sure we all understood exactly what we're looking at. Thank you.
I really appreciate that, Representative.
So the upshot here, you see the difference between actual revenues of $3.47 billion of personal income in those 3 months relative to $3.2 billion expected is $260 million of additional resources just in those last 6-7 weeks of the biennium, pushing our estimates even higher. And like I say, you know, this is beyond what we would expect, both in terms of the investment income, which we know is always volatile, the pieces like capital gains and things that are tied to the markets and the like, but also for these withholdings, which traditionally have been really in line with what we see in terms of our economic measures of wages and income growth. And our economic forecast for our wages has been right on, pretty much spot on, but over the last 2 years now running, or 2.5 even, we've seen these withholdings for tax purposes much higher. And here we're seeing 8% rates year over year, and they've been even stronger than that. And here we go starting into this biennium, we're still in that 8 to 10% window, much stronger than the underlying economy would suggest we are. And so we're trying to get our heads around this, you know, to what extent is this a permanent phenomenon or timing phenomenon? And we're trying to dig into some of the DOR data in terms of maybe additional pension income or retirement income adding to this withholding over time, or some kind of structural shift. But we know one of the culprits here is taxpayer behavior, given that we've seen such a huge shift in both personal and corporate income taxes after the federal tax reforms. Taxpayers really do respond to federal tax changes, and we've certainly seen that here, and we're getting pulled along with it. So again, really the challenge here is to try to determine how much of this is permanent versus temporary. Yes, sorry, Chair Haas.
Yes, do we have portion and whiskey?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. McMullen, I see it says personal income tax here. So we're just looking at personal income tax. So we're not looking at corporate, which I know is significantly smaller. But my question is, does the corporate income tax track the same way or similar to what we're seeing here?
Yes, Representative Reschke, Chair Haas, even more so. The corporate income tax, although it's come off a little bit in recent months, it's still very much inflated relative to where it typically is. Following the federal tax reforms, we saw our corporate collections go up 50%. So we were typically at a running rate before that of about $600 million a year. And towards the end of the biennium, we're running at about $900 million a year, much higher than we've ever seen in the past. And so some of this, and even if it is all related to the federal law, some of it may still be permanent insofar as it may have increased the corporate base, some of the new definitions, and it may stick with us. But again, it's very challenging because this growth is clearly not sustainable, you know, compared with what we're seeing, even the healthy growth in the economy.
Representative Findley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you think that when the Federal Jobs and Tax Act Oregon after that has implemented a new W-4 system to change the withholdings to hopefully remove that or underpayment of taxes. Is that factored in any of these numbers? Have you started to see that take effect?
Yes, Representative Finley, Chair Haas. Hard to see in the numbers yet, but we know something, you know, that it is likely to, that these changes in withholding tables have traditionally given us big gaps between what we're seeing in the economy and what we're seeing in terms of withholding, and that is one of the suspects. This was unfortunately unavoidable this time because Oregon traditionally hasn't had its own W-2, that we've relied on the federal ones, and we've made calculations based on the allowances that were put into the federal W-2. Well, with the tax reform change, the federal W-2 changed its character greatly, and so it no longer looks anything like it used to, and we've lost these allowances that we used to use to calculate Oregon withholding. And so So at first the DOR put guidance out on the website, and then they got out a real W-2, but I think it's going to take a while before that filters through the economy. First of all, you know, current employees, you know, they would just default to what they withheld before, you know, their employers would, and unless you changed a job, it's unclear how fast this is going to be adopted and the changes in terms of the withholding rates.
Representative Marsh, did you have a question?
Thank you. So how long is it going to take us to sort this out, what's actually happening? Do we assume that after this tax year and a year from now, when we're looking at the end of the next tax year, that whatever we see there is real at that point? Or what's your sense of timeline here?
Yeah, Vice Chair Marsh, Chair Haas. Unfortunately, as a realist, by the time we'll sort this out, there'll be some other big shock that'll mess up the picture, and so we won't. We'll still be chasing our tails, but it's going to take some time, particularly on the corporate side, and the big uncertain piece, like the repatriation piece, that the DOR will, by the second half of the next biennium, come up with an estimate of that, but that'll still be somewhat uncertain because corporate filing years are different, and so it takes a long time, a couple of years, before we actually get return data. And that's going to happen on a variety of fronts, on the state front as well, in particular with the new corporate activity tax. Although we're going to start to see some estimated payments get made when it rolls out in 2020, we won't know whether firms are overpaying or underpaying, because the firms themselves probably won't know. There's going to be a lot of uncertainty in terms of how that rolls out. And so it's going to take until, you know, the spring or summer of 2021 before we actually start to get hard return data to be able to take a look back at how the collections have been performing over time and what's exactly going on. And so unfortunately that's going to be the case with these federal reforms as well, and in particular some of the behavioral impacts of the tax law are going to take a while to roll out as well. Whether somebody decides I want to be a contractor instead of an employee because of the tax law, you know, you might not do that overnight. Or I want to change my corporate entity from a C corp to an S corp, or from an S corp to a C corp, or whatever you may be doing in order to react. It's going to take a while for the accountants to get the guidance to their clients and actually, you know, change business structures and the like. And so it's going to take a while before all of this spills out.
Marky, it sounds like you're saying that the corporate is up because the Federal Tax Act cut federal taxes, and therefore there is more profit and income on which they're paying taxes on. Is that what I hear you say?
Yeah, Senator Haas, possibly. To a certain extent, it could be that now we have broadened the base in terms of taxable income, and Oregon's carrying forward with that, so that more businesses are subject to tax. But another part that's clearly going on is a timing issue and behavioral, because firms are try to minimize their tax liability, particularly federal liability. Our accountants that we talk to say that the state liability and state changes are a second order of importance. People really care about the federal liability. And when we saw these changes, it gave a lot of incentive to, the tax rate's going to go down. I want to pull all of my costs into 2017, push all of my income to what extent I can into 2018 when the taxes are lower. I think this big wave, a lot of it had to do with just trying to position your income and costs into a lower liability situation.
Thank you.
So we have even more. When we came in May, we were saying, oh boy, we've never seen a processing season like this. And then it continued towards the end. And so what does that mean? Well, with our unique kicker law, that means a bigger personal income tax kicker, where we are now up to $1.57 billion personal income tax kicker, which is a share of liability, is now the third largest on record, you see here. So here next year, when individuals file in Oregon, they'll receive a refundable credit of around 15% of their 2018 liability will be come out of the stream during the next tax season. So the way to read this chart is in each biennium, this is the size of that credit or liability. It's not the size of the forecast error. You know, we have this 2% threshold, but that's for all the general fund that's not corporate and for the whole 2-year period. And then we pay it back through the personal income tax system, which is a 1-year personal tax liability. And so that blows this up to a 15% number. But as you see here, this is not entirely rare that we have an event like this about every, this is a once in a decade event, usually, you know, in the heart of the business cycle. Only twice we've hit what you see here is the sweet spot, that we define that as just between the 0% and 2% threshold, so that there's more money than the legislature was expecting, but it does not trigger the kicker. And the one time in 89-91 where with a 2/3 vote, the legislature suspended the kicker. But nevertheless, we have our black mark on our forecasting record to put along with those others in the past. It's very similar to 85-87, and not coincidentally, at that time we had a big federal tax law change as well, which shifted the timing of payments at that time as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a technical question. As the payments come into the state of Oregon, they're banked, and those excess dollars will be returned as a credit or a refund. What happens to the interest earnings on these billions of dollars? Who controls that money? Does that get returned as part of the kicker, or does the state retain the interest earnings and put it into its general fund?
I see Representative Smith, Chair Haas. Yeah, well, cash flow used to be a much bigger problem when we put the kicker out as a check around Christmas time. At that point, we had to get the balances, and for the record kicker in 05-07, we had to borrow basically the whole thing from the bond market. So worse than earning interest, we were actually losing a lot of interest in order to pay this out. Now that it comes out of the stream, we never actually see it. You know, we saw those huge numbers for the end of the tax season. Well, this is just getting pulled out of that, where we had $2 billion in withholding alone for that 3-month period. So, you know, it's coming out of, you know, it's just coming out of the stream, so we don't see it. But in a way, you can think of that as gaining interest insofar as right now we have these big balances. We get this big ending balance as a result of these kicker, which is, the good part about getting more money than we expected is we don't have to burn it in the backyard. We can keep it and potentially have that offset some of the weakness of revenues that we expect
going forward. And so as a result, we do have massive balances, and that'll be our last chart when we combine that with our reserve funds. And we do earn interest on those. Unfortunately, not as much as we expected. The interest rates are going down, and this is lowering our fund forecast slightly, but that's on the edges. It's still a good story with the legislature for the first time ever having a $500 million ending balance was put into law here a couple months ago, which is much larger than we've ever seen before. And now we can add, as you'll see, about 300 to that from this forecast. So we're still at a pretty hefty ending balance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. McMullen, thanks for giving me the median and the mean. That was one of my questions. So you answered that one already. But the corporate kicker, that doesn't go back to corporations. Where does that money go to, the $676 million?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Reske. Yeah, so the 2017 legislature directed that corporate kicker money go to as additional funding to K-12 programs. And so that is additional money for K-12. It's kind of vague in terms of the statute of what additional money is. So that's why I put at the bottom here, at $676 million, that's a large corporate kicker.
Yeah.
But wouldn't expect $676 million in additional resources to be dedicated to education. In the May forecast, we were saying $616 million or so was going to be at the corporate kicker at that point.
Mark, I think it wasn't the legislature, it was a statewide ballot measure, right?
Oh, well, I'm sorry, Chair Haas. Yes, it was. It was through the initiative process. Yes, no, I'm sorry. My brain is soft today. So yes, so through the initiative process, no, I don't know. So I said, well, in May, when the legislature got together and made a budget, we were saying $616 million. And so I guess you could consider $60 million to be additional. Although, you know, if this were reversed and the kicker were $60 million below, I don't necessarily see going back and pulling money out of education either. So I'm not sure how to manage around this. I'd leave that for the budget folks. But nevertheless, that's big, and the corporate kicker is clearly has something to do with the Tax Cuts and Job Act, in particular. This repatriation piece is a good chunk of it. So yes, the distribution, as Representative Reske mentioned, is here available. This is back of the envelope estimates of what the typical filing household would get in Oregon, depending on their income level. And as you see, we do higher income households have much higher Oregon tax liability and therefore get a much larger kicker payment. So this really does range from the median household getting expecting just under $350 worth of a credit to the top 1% of our households looking at over $15,000 of a credit on their tax return. So not spread equally across all income groups.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just a clarification on that particular slide. And the reason it's not equal amongst all groups is because the top group pays a heck of a lot more in taxes. Is that not correct?
That is absolutely correct, Senator Knope. We look at it's a share of their 2018 liability. So you've already filed your taxes for 2018. You said how much that liability, and it'll be roughly 15% of that. And so folks with big liability get big money back.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so to clarify what Senator Knope said, the dollar amount's not equal, but the percentage is equal.
That's correct. Percentage of the liability, yes. Yeah, liability and people's underlying tax rate differs based on credits and all sorts of deductions and things. But yes, in terms of what their liability was in 2018, it's an equal percentage for every taxpayer. So looking ahead now to the current biennium, which is what we care about now, is with 2017-19 in our rearview mirror, we have a little accounting to do to take note of the legislative changes that were enacted during the session. It was a very busy session, and in particular, we've got some legislative changes which put a pretty large downward pressure on the general fund. Pretty large cuts in terms of personal income alone, being nearly $1 billion reduction in the general fund revenues. This isn't a reduction in overall revenues. Much of it has to do with the corporate activity tax being enacted, which is not being put in the general fund, which, thank goodness, does not make it part of the kicker calculation. Thank you all for that facet of the law. But so when, for example, the corporate activity tax was passed, and part of that HB 3427, I believe, had with it some rate relief at the lower income brackets for Oregonians. And so that income tax rate cuts, those show up as less general fund revenue. And it also does eat into some of the corporate tax, traditional corporate tax and minimum tax payers that we had. And so that shows up as less general fund revenue as well. And a couple other items, the expiring tax expenditures that were extended and the like, all add up to a pretty big hit on the general fund, not the overall budget situation for the state, because there's now a fund for student success with where the new tax money is going to go into, which will offset these losses. But from a general fund perspective, the numbers look pretty rough. And so even with just 2020 kick-in of the new laws, you'll see here the close of session changes reduced the general fund forecast by over $300 million. On a smaller scale, 17-19 expenditures were revised up by the legislature by a little $3 million, so that's in there as well, pulling down the forecast. Since in terms of the economics or the non-policy related stuff at the right, how has our new forecast compared to the close of session? That we see a little bit stronger. With a stable economic outlook, we're not much has changed. You see here almost $100 million in additional revenue. Most of that is coming from corporate. Again, we saw this huge boom in corporate revenue. We're trying to dissect how much of that is permanent. We've decided to keep a little bit more of it as a permanent flow into the system. And so when you combine that extra revenue with this larger beginning balance there of $214 million, that beginning balance comes from what we just talked about in terms of 17-19. The big surge of money that came in at the end of the year is now in the balances, and that's what you see there. All told, this forecast basically at $300 million kind of wipes out the legislative changes that we saw at the close of session, leaving us kind of unchanged from May.
Rick Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you just give a little more elaboration on what constitutes a one-time transfer?
Yeah, what constitutes a one-time transfer? Yes, there are several of these typically in law. A lot of them have to do with different agency budgets, where at the end of the biennium, we sweep $10 million from agency X and another 20 from agency Y and the like. They can also be settlement money. Sometimes if we get a big settlement money, that comes into one-time transfers as well.
Just a quick follow-up. And again, I'm trying to educate myself this morning. Can you share with me within this revenue forecast where the marijuana income comes into the state? Does that come through the liquor category? Or is that captured in another location?
Yeah, Representative Smith, similar to the corporate activity tax, in the wisdom of the policymakers, this was not put into the general fund, or at least not a portion of it yet. It's all allocated to different special other funds.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
But we do at the end of
some of the same ones, so you just keep asking.
We're going to get more of these. So at the end of our appendix on our quarterly report is getting longer and longer. We already do the lottery distributions, and now we have a marijuana distributions table in the back, and this time we have the brand new corporate activity tax distribution tables as well. And I expect these to only expand as we can go forward.
Rep. Findlay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question. Are you projecting in the corporate activity or the corporate income tax a reduction in that level in response to the corporate activities tax? So that has to affect the corporate income tax levels fairly significantly.
Yes, there is some interplay there. Now we haven't repealed our corporate income tax, so that still is there. Mm-hmm. But there certainly is some interplay, particularly with the corporate minimum tax.
But what if when the corporate activity tax engages and corporations start paying that will reduce their corporate income tax liability, yes. I would assume, by a fairly significant amount of money.
Yeah, I'm going to have to defer to legislative revenue, Chris, on this one, given that our process is to use their estimates until we start seeing real-world numbers that contradict those. In this case, it's going to be quite a while until we see any real-world numbers that can prove or disprove. I think the only thing that would stand in the way between before this spring-summer of 21, when we start getting return data, I think pretty much a recession is the only thing I can think that would make us want to alter the LRO estimate, or forecast at this time. So I will defer the size of that corporate interplay to Chris. It's his work.
The negative there for the corporate income tax is due to precisely the mechanism you're talking about. They're paying more in this tax. It's a deductible expense, so that reduces taxable income. And that $55 million is pretty much a one-year impact for tax year 20.
Okay.
That estimate is based on the estimated share of the CAT that is paid by the C corporations. So not all of the CAT. The CAT applies to all business structures. So we take that, how much of that is right. paid by corporations, and the deductibility factor shows up as a negative here. Another piece that Mark alluded to within the personal income tax is for all of the non-C corporate businesses have that same effect, and that's a piece of that negative number there as well.
Okay, thank you.
So on a whole, this goes forward. Now, the LRO altered their typical table to you to compare everything to the close of session so that it would be more reasonable in terms of how much more or less we have today than we thought for your purposes. But in terms of raw changes, as we go forward, these, general fund reductions are pretty large. And so from just stepping back, it looks like we have a reduction in the general fund going forward for five biennia or so. But again, that's more about the color of the money and which pot we're putting it into rather than a loss in resources. So looking forward into the future biennia, we are particularly in the current one looking at a real slow revenue outlook for 1921. Even without a recession, we're expecting that it's going to be hard to match the revenues that we saw in the last biennium. Even with our baseline slow growth scenario here, we have just too much going on. We have the timing of the federal policies. How much of it just pulling forward the liability, and are we going to have a hangover going forward because of the federal tax law? And we just fleshed out the state where we've got a downward impact on the general fund revenues. Combine that with a $1.6 billion kicker and slower economic growth, and it's going to be a lot of headwinds for revenue growth in the next biennium. Of course, you've already budgeted to this number, and so that's positive. But if we do see a recession, of course, these numbers are going to turn much, much darker. Then going forward, some of these temporary factors settle out, and eventually we get to 9 to 10% biennium revenue growth, which is okay, not as strong as what we've become accustomed to in past periods of economic expansion, largely due to the demographics and the aging workforce and aging Oregonians are we're going to receive a smaller share of income, and income itself will be growing less, and so in the out years, we expect relatively modest rates of revenue growth. So with that, I'm going to pass it along to Josh to make a couple comments about some of these non-general fund sources as well as the reserves.
Just a couple comments on the non-general fund. To get back to Representative Smith's question about marijuana, it's not shown here. The forecast is relatively unchanged. We did make one minor tweak to the legislation as part of one of the tax compliance bills. Increased auditing function in DOR will result in a couple $100,000 of increased marijuana revenue a year based on the initial estimates. But other than that, the sales seem to be tracking pretty well, and our overall marijuana forecast is relatively unchanged. On the lottery, lottery is probably the one that shows the largest changes, and that's not because the economic outlook has changed or expectations of video lottery or scratch tickets or whatever has changed as well. This is the first time we have included sports betting into the forecast. It had not been included previously, and so we have worked, the research team at Lottery has done a lot of work trying to estimate what the size of the sports betting market in Oregon will be. We've worked with them to extend that over our forecast horizon and turn it into actual available resources, or at least a first estimate for that. And that's increased resources by about $8 million this biennium, and that goes up to about $40, $45 million per biennium in the out years once the market matures and we get the ramp-up period and what have you. Of course, this was all dedicated to the PERS Employer Incentive Fund. There's a little bit of ambiguity, or not necessarily ambiguity, but a little bit of difference in the statute and the way the allocations flow out, and I know the budget teams and legislative council is working on tweaking the language. For right now, if we have a $10 million increase in sports betting money, that results in a $13 million increase in transfers out of the Economic Development Fund, because those constitutional distributions to the Education Stability Fund, to Parks and Natural Resources, and the Veterans Fund all receive part of that $10 million, but then the $10 million is also transferred to the Employer Incentive Fund. So while we have $8 million more in resources due to sports betting, we have a little bit less in available resources on net because, again, we're transferring out more than $8 million due to the way the laws interact or the way the statute is written. Again, not a problem. It's still positive ending balance and more resources overall in the big picture. But that is one consideration I know is being talked about regarding that.
Yes, Rep. Knows.
Thank you, Senator Hass. A couple of times in these presentations when we talk about lottery, we were very worried about casino gambling, particularly in the state of Washington. And then I remember one time in one of these, the prediction was people were going to drive to Washington and gamble, and then it didn't materialize. Is that still the case, or are we starting to see an uptick now in that? Or is traffic still the one benefit that we have?
That's our strategy.
people don't want to drive to gamble.
There is an impact. Particularly among retailers along the border. And in fact, this last year, they continue to be down, right? We're now over 2 years since the casino, Alinea Resort Casino, had opened in Southwest Washington. And so there is an impact. It's just, it's running 10 to 15% of those initial expectations. So the impact's relatively minimal, particularly at the statewide level. And I do think the congestion along the interstate is a benefit to lottery revenue.
It's the only benefit, but we'll take it.
And at this point, we're not expecting that impact to widen. It's been over 2 years. Typically, casinos, if you look elsewhere in the country, when a new casino opens, whether it's in Philadelphia or D.C. or whatever the case may be, they ramp up for about 1.5 to 3 years, somewhere in that range before they kind of stabilize or even begin to shrink. And now that we're over 2 years since the Alinea Resort is open, we think that initial ramp up is finished. What we're waiting for is maybe phase two. They've opened the gaming floor and they have a steakhouse, but phase two, maybe a hotel or convention center, something like that, to turn it more into a destination and not a day trip. Then we would reevaluate those considerations. Okay. And then the other thing on lottery, given the uncertain economic outlook and consultation with our lottery advisory group, for the first time in our office's history, we did do some alternative scenario work for lottery revenues in terms of if we had a mild recession, what would that do? The upshot is it would be relatively flat resources for lottery. They wouldn't see a large decline. The baseline calls for ongoing growth, but the mild recession where consumer spending tapers to a decent degree would be relatively unchanged. So resources for the budget would not grow, but they also wouldn't shrink. Now, of course, if we had a more severe recession than the thing we modeled, those numbers would change. But that's as something we did. If you're interested in that, it's buried in the back of our document. And we've already talked about the corporate activity tax as well. Finally, we've talked about it a couple times already. You know, we have healthy reserves relative to Oregon's history, right? Right now, we're looking at $1.2, $1.3 billion combined today in the Education Stability Fund and the Rainy Day Fund. Add on the $800 million-plus ending balance in the general fund today, the $500 that was left in the legislative process, plus the additional $300 in resources that Mark was talking about a few minutes ago, that brings our ending balances or our effective reserves to over $2 billion, 12% of the general fund. This will aid tremendously whenever that next recession does come. It should help on the revenue side, the revenue shortfall we typically see during a downturn. However, we also know spending increases, so this will be unlikely to fully hold the budget harmless due to the increased expenditures on needs-based programs when Oregonians lose their jobs, but it should help on the revenue shortfall side, at least for the first biennium after a shock.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really glad we're able to take a look at slide 16. For Senator Knope and Senator Hass and myself, we had the privilege of going through the 2001-03 biennium, in which we got called into multiple special sessions. And there really was a lack of preparedness at that time to sustain current service level, as you just pointed out. And you know, one of the things that I would share with the general public is our co-chairs on Ways and Means have done a phenomenal job of building in those cushions, as you just shared, preparing for when that rainy day does occur. And even though current, you know, we anticipate revenues, if you go back to slide 14, net revenue being about 3.5% lower and current service level maintaining or continuing to rise, our co-chairs have done a phenomenal job of preparing Oregon for those difficult times, and I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, I totally agree, and it just, you know, the last couple of forecasts, it warms my heart to see these reserve fund balances where they are, given the experience that we had. Those tough years.
The rating agencies really like it too. Right. We're going to do a big bond sale coming up here in a week or two, and they always make sure we include this one.
Any other questions for our economist, Rep. Smith?
Thank you. If we could go back to nearly the top, I held this question earlier regarding manufacturing. Several of us here on this panel represent manufacturers and exporters that conduct business in value-added agriculture. And one of the things that District 57 saw during the last recession was while the rest of the state was challenged by loss of jobs, those in the Columbia Basin actually saw a net increase in employment. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, as we're looking at tax policy and we're looking at social policy, does it make sense for this body to look at those segments of our economy that are stable through recessionary times and try to enhance and support them, not just in District 57, but throughout the state of Oregon? The reality is, people are going to eat a potato. They're going to eat an onion. They're going to eat an apple. And whether the economy is good or not, those type of items continue to be consumed.
Absolutely, Representative Smith, Chair Hass, that's true. And part of the reason Oregon's been so volatile is that we are really exposed to resource and manufacturing industries relative to the typical state. And as we become more diverse, hopefully some of this volatility will go away. But you're right, the Columbia Basin was a great test case during the Great Recession. For one, the pain wasn't as bad because there wasn't as much of a housing boom leading up to it, so there wasn't a bunch of a housing boom bust, so that was great. But then it was also, like you say, the industrial mix. We had a huge run-up in wind power at the time, so there was a ton of investment going in right at the perfect time when the private demand was dying. We still had the cleanup at the Umatilla Arms Depot, so millions of federal dollars pouring into the region. You mentioned the agricultural prices. It wasn't just out east with the wheat or whatever, the fruit for the gorge area or whatever was what prices were great for that too. All kinds of little things, even the new unmanned aerial vehicle industry and other smaller things too. You know, we had just a whole lot going on, and so that was really the one part of the state that was spared the most pain during the recession. And luckily, even though a lot of those drivers have gone away, it's surprisingly been very strong during the expansion as well, even though all that federal money stopped flowing in and the wind investment pulled way back and the ag pricing softened. Still doing pretty darn well, leaning on a lot of transportation, and Boardman is just unbelievable, you know, and so, yes, industrial diversity is great. Getting there for some of the rural areas is more difficult because a lot of times connectivity is the issue, whether it be traditional transportation infrastructure or broadband or the like, but some way to connect with the urban areas and lose that competitive disadvantage.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Senator. I also had a question up in the earlier parts of the presentation, but you were on a roll, so we didn't want to interrupt. Around wages, I mean, I think one of the good pieces of news in here was that increase in wages, which you notice happened roughly over the last 4 years, which is also around the same period that Oregon started increasing our minimum wage. So my question is, can you sort out the different factors that may be spurring that wage growth?
Yes, Representative Marsh, I think so. In terms of minimum wage, it is helping the wage growth, but at a big aggregate number like this, it's hard to see just because minimum wage workers are a small part of the aggregate economy, particularly when we're talking about average wages, because the big high wages really, you know, overwhelm the picture. But that's part of it in here. But a lot more of it has to do with the scarcity of labor making it paid more. It's just so hard to find workers. We hear that in almost every industry in Oregon. And so employers are having to dig deeper down into the pile of resumes, and they're having to pay more just to bring folks in, because we're seeing this really across industries, which is positive. And it's particularly positive for our low and middle income households. The low and middle income households are seeing really impressive income gains in Oregon, particularly relative to other states, where we've seen our median household income now finally catch up to the U.S. For the median household, largely because of wages. Because when we're looking at the lower end of the income spectrum, these households don't have a lot of investment income or other kinds of income other than their wages and potentially some transfer payments. But the wages are very, very important, and so this is helping. And we're also seeing wage growth across our regions as well as across our industries. And so that as well is very encouraging. As long as this expansion continues, hopefully those improvements will continue to deepen.
Thank you.
Representative Finley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You talked about manufacturing and the reduction in hours of manufacturing. What percentage is that? Is that a substantial number, or is it a minor number? So
41 or 42.
Right. Representative Finley, Chair Haas, this is a very big decline, right? We're talking an hour and a half a week in the last 6 months. And that's on the durable goods.
Non-durable.
The reason we're not showing the non-durable is we think there might be some data problems in the Oregon figures. They've been really weak for a couple years now. And so we're still digging into whether it's coming to be honest, the weakness is coming in food manufacturing outside the Portland region. And that doesn't really necessarily narrow down, because food manufacturing is strong on the North Coast. It's strong here in the Valley. It's strong in Southern Oregon, and it's strong out East, right? It's really the only place that doesn't have a massive food industry is, I guess, Central Oregon for the most part. And so this weakness, we're still digging into it. Our friends at the employment department have been looking into it. We're trying to figure out what's going on the non-durable side, but we're not showing that because we think there maybe is just some miscoding or something going on. We're not entirely sure. But the durable goods is something that had held up, even as we're seeing the weakness in the non-durable side in the last couple of years. The durable goods look good. They're looking really solid. But at both the U.S. level, they're down half an hour a week, which is a little less concerning. But it really, the overtime hours are down two or three, right? They went from 4 hours overtime at the U.S. level to maybe 1 hour of overtime, roughly speaking. Here in Oregon, we tend to work a little less overtime hours due to the composition of our industries. But it's down an hour and a half in the last 6 months, which is a
big number.
Which is a recessionary decline. But we're not in a recession as of today, and so it's a cause for concern. But it's not yet depleting the top line data we're looking at either.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go back to slide 7 with the wages? And glad to see this, but it's only half of the story in my mind, because if I get a 5% wage increase, but my cost of living goes up 10%, I'm falling behind. So is there any data that you have, or is there any metric that shows us what Oregon's cost of living is doing as wages are going up? So I just want to make sure that we're ahead of the curve and we're not just seeing half of that story.
Representative Reske, unfortunately, the BLS stopped providing consumer price data for the Portland and Salem Consolidated Metro Area for years and years. Just this year, we were the last one.
Last year,
we were the last region cut from the data, and so we don't get specific anymore. But the way that used to differ, that really regionally, the one component of that consumer price index that differed were the housing costs, whether it be direct housing prices or imputed rents that people pay. And that's where we've diverged, and that's where we have issues in terms of, you know, the price of housing. And so given that, we've seen a little bit of affordability improvement as income has grown in the last couple of years, but largely across the state in both rural and urban areas, we do have issue with housing affordability and making, you know, these wages go less far.
Just to add on to that, if we adjust both household incomes and these average wages for either inflation via the CPI, Consumer Price Index, or the PCE, or the regional price parities that the Bureau of Economic Analysis publishes at the U.S. level, they publish them for all metro areas and states, we are seeing incomes rising faster than that. But of course, they've been relatively stagnant for 20 years now, right? There's movements around that stagnant trend, but we've made up the recessionary decline. And so these rises in recent years have been outpacing cost of living increases, inflation measures, and what have you. And we're just now barely above where we were in the late 1990s on an inflation-adjusted basis, but we're not significantly above that. And of course, if we go around the state to the different regions, that picture looks considerably different. Some regions of the state, even with recent wage gains and income gains, they remain considerably lower than they did 10 or 20 years ago. So there's a lot of variation there.
Okay, gentlemen, I appreciate your presentation today. My takeaway is, in spite of the future, the possible headwinds, is that Oregon's economy is really strong.
Right,
you're
now
talking about higher wages, more people working, expansion continuing.
Yeah, true.
And you missed the sweet spot by about $1.5 billion. That's about
close.
But you had some obstacles out there with the federal tax exemption. So thank you very much. Thank you, panel. Great questions today. With that, the Senate Interim Committee will adjourn.
And we will also adjourn the House Interim Committee.